Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. Thanks for joining me, and it's one of my favorite parts of doing Your Call when we get to talk to journalists. And today we have a two-part show. The first part will be dealing with the situation in the Philippines, and we're very fortunate to have an award-winning Manila-based investigative journalist, Raisa Robles. She's been tracking the Marcos family's aggressive efforts to actually come back to power in the Philippines. Raisa is a blogger and a correspondent for the South China Morning Post, located in Hong Kong, and she's written a bestseller entitled Marcos, Martial Law, Never Again. And Ms. Robles has studied the relationship between the Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte with the family of the Marcoses. We thought that we had heard the end of the Marcoses, and she says, not so fast. President Duterte himself has been in the eye of international media in the last year or so, most notably possibly for a very foul-mouthed diatribe as it relates to former President Obama, but mostly because of his bloody war on drugs that has left literally some streets littered with bodies. So looking forward to a very interesting conversation for the first half of the show with author and journalist Raisa Robles. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start by giving us an idea of who Rodrigo Duterte is. Where did he come from? How did he come to power?
Okay. Rodrigo Duterte was a longtime mayor from southern Philippines in the Christian city of Davao. And ironically, he was first put there as an acting mayor by no less than the democracy icon, the late President Corazon Aquino. And then he rose to fame there. And he was able to bring peace to Davao, peace and order, and he was able to make Davao progress. And people who have gone to Davao have told me in very glowing words that it was the only place in the Philippines where they felt safe walking at midnight. But underneath, there was always an undercurrent, you know, that there were mysterious killings going on in Davao, especially of petty criminals and also drug addicts and those who sell drugs on the streets. And in 2009, Human Rights Watch itself, the one in base in New York, came out with a report wherein it was the first time it was mentioned that there was something called a Davao Death Squad. It did not name Mayor Duterte as mastermind, but it pointed out that Mayor Duterte, when he was apprised about it, did not do anything, you know, to run after or to investigate even the so-called Davao Death Squad. And now recently, there are at least two former police officers who have come out openly and said, we were part of the Davao Death Squad, and we did the killings for Mayor Duterte.
So it's obvious that when he was sworn in, back in June of 2016, that people knew what they were voting for, that they wanted a law and order president. Is it safe to say that people knew what they were getting, or are they shocked?
No, people knew and they wanted him as president because of his promise to eradicate criminality and to eradicate drugs in their own neighborhoods. A lot of people were tired, I think, of petty crime. It was not being addressed properly by the previous government. And then people welcomed a fresh change. You know, he is so unlike the previous president. The previous president was kind of flat, you know, and he's very even-tempered. But this one, he cusses a lot. and he appealed to women, and he's very charismatic, and he's a very touchy-feely kind of person.
Hmm.
He was
That's
so
starting
different.
To sound familiar. We'll get to that in just a moment, but let's talk about the fact that he's been in office just over maybe a year and a half. At what point did people perhaps start to change? Did the population start to say, wait a minute, this is not what we bought into when we elected him? Just talk about the drug war that he has waged.
Yes, but let me clarify that. Mm. Although his popularity, according to the latest poll survey, has gone down 18 points, which is quite a drop, he remains still very popular. But I think people started questioning how they felt about him starting 2 months ago and last month, when young men who didn't seem to be involved in drugs, and they were students, and they were gunned down, and some of them were children of Filipinos overseas, and they were ironically supporters of Rodrigo Duterte. Even the persons who were killed, the young men who were killed, had openly advocated his war on drugs.
And to some extent, he has said, and this is a quote, he is, quote, happy to slaughter millions of drug users, and he dismissed the deaths of children as collateral damage, and in many ways he actually encouraged civilians to kill people who they thought were either drug pushers or even drug addicts, drug users, right?
Yes, that's true. I myself was shocked because on the very night after his presidential inauguration last year, he went to the poorest section in Manila, and he told the people there, that's called Tondo, he told the residents there that if you have, if your neighbor has a drug addict for a son, I think it would help if you are the ones who killed your neighbor's son, because they're not going to do the killing. I was shocked that a president of the Republic of the Philippines would say such a thing, you know? Instead of love thy neighbor, it's kill thy neighbor.
It's insane in some ways, yes?
Yes.
And about 3,450 people have actually been killed. He calls them drug personalities.
Actually, there's more.
More than that?
Yeah, over 1,000. But you know who he reminds me of? His language, you know? It's very, overblown. Saddam Hussein talks like that. Also, Gaddafi talks like that. And Idi Amin talks like that. And then what his presidential aides try to do is that they, after he talks like that, and the media come out with exactly the words that he says when he compared himself to Hitler, you know, and then they will tell the media, no, he didn't really mean it that way, you know. So they try to redefine what he says.
So he has this bigger-than-life personality. Is that what people are responding to, despite the 18-point drop in popularity? Clearly, he still enjoys a great deal of support. So
yes.
Are people responding to the bigger-than-life personality?
Yes, I think so. And the fact that I think, you know, some Filipinos, I mean, human beings, some human beings have this dark streak in them, you know, and he appeals to that dark streak that wants to resolve problems just by killing. And he, in his campaign, presidential campaign, he has made people afraid for their families. And I think that was his secret, that he had made Filipinos scared, so scared for their families, and they believe that a war, an actual war on drugs, was something that had to be done, Because if you have, you know, it's the linguistics of the thing, the language. If you have a war, then you necessarily have collateral damage, and you accept that kind of collateral damage. And this is what some of my friends have told me.
Well, it seems like it has spiraled into something else, not just a war on drugs, but a war on drug users, the families of drug lords and drug users. Just yesterday, he apparently threatened to expel the ambassadors who represent the European Union, suggesting that he would give them 24 hours to leave the country. I mean, it almost sounds like cowboy language, you know, get out of Dodge in 24 hours. And he's faced a lot of very serious potential sanctions, but that doesn't seem to have stopped him. Is it because people still support him?
No. Well, his presidential aides are now backpedaling. But the truth is, President Duterte has poor impulse control. He speaks what his heart says or what his temper makes him say. You know, it's like a man who does not have control of his hot temper, and that's what he is. And he doesn't mince words.
Well, speaking of not mincing words, he had a few choice words for former President Barack Obama. I think that's when he first kind of came into the consciousness of many Americans, when President Obama began to decry his use of violence in the war on drugs. He had some choice words for President Obama, but he seems to be having a very symbiotic relationship with President Trump.
Yes, that's true.
Why do you think that is?
Okay, I'm thinking that they may have shared a political strategist, and I just feel it that this is something to be more deeply to be investigated, that the Philippine electoral campaign was actually a test bed for the Trump campaign, because the two campaigns shared the same things, and I think the link actually is the Marcoses. The Marcoses have long used that lobby group, Black Manafort, and Manafort was directly linked to the Trump campaign.
So, and Paul Manafort, the former campaign chairman for the Trump campaign.
Yes, I don't know if it's Paul Manafort, but I know that the Marcoses have always been using the Manafort, that group, even during martial law. And then the Marcoses secretly supported President Duterte in his run. So I think that was their contribution.
And that's the essence of your book, too, yes? It's called Marcos, Martial Law, Never Again. So just talk about what appears to be the resurgence of the Marcoses and their influence.
They've always wanted to get back to power. And it's just a pity that all through the administrations after the Marcoses were booted out, there was no such attempt to preserve the memory of martial law and to teach children, to educate the new generation. When Senator Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr., ran for the Senate in 2010, by that time, a new generation of voters who never knew martial law from their own experience had come in. And that was the generation that he tapped. And also, in the government, there have always been secret Marcos supporters, even up to now. And that was what they also tapped. And so, another thing that's I find funny is that a lot of the Marcos supporters, especially from the poorer, you know, the poorer sector, they think that they have been promised that if they vote for Marcos and then he becomes president, they will take part in the Marcos hidden wealth.
You're talking about Ferdinand Marcos Jr.
Yes.
Okay. And he has his eyes on the presidency. Now,
yes.
There are a lot of Filipino Americans who are no doubt watching things unfold there. And your book is basically a warning to people so that the next generation that may not remember what it was like under Marcos not to make the same mistakes. So what is it that concerns you about the resurgence? And is Ferdinand Marcos Jr. enjoying popularity there?
Yes. Because when I wrote that book, I thought that it would be a warning to future generations who have not yet been born. I didn't know that it would serve as a warning for, you know, the millennials right now. And my book actually is a study of authoritarianism. You know, how a one man, very charming, charismatic, could rise to power and use the same and exploit, you know, democracy in order to keep for himself, you know, dictatorial powers. And that's what happened with Marcos. And I fear that that is what could happen with President Duterte, because he is being sorely tempted by people around him. And President Duterte has actually been an admirer of the former dictator, and his father used to serve the former dictator right inside the presidential palace. You know, so the links are very, very close, and I do believe that the Marcoses is just a phone call away from Duterte.
Well, apparently the Marcos family has amassed just a huge fortune, anywhere from $5 to $10 billion. And so to what extent is it possible that we have yet another personality waiting in the wings? And we've already talked a bit about the power of personality. So with that kind of financing and the cult of personality behind him, is Ferdinand Marcos Jr. viable as a presidential candidate?
Okay.
Could he win?
Well, the thing is, he lost in the vice presidential election. It was a very close call. There was a slim margin between him and Vice President Lenny Robredo, who came in from behind and who was a last-minute candidate. But can he win? Yes, he could still win. In fact, he could win if the Supreme Court rules that he is the legitimate vice president, you know. So he could win by judicial ruling in the next few years or few months. We don't know. Okay, the personality of Bongbong Marcos is far different from that of his father. I think he's a bit lazy, I mean, compared to his father. His father was very brilliant. He's not. Actually, his sister has more of the temperament of the father and the brilliance of the father, except that his sister, she has an overhang, a big political overhang, because she was actually, there was a civil suit filed here in the U.S. against the, she was accused of instigating the killing of a student back in Manila. Mm. So that has never been settled. So,
but does she have political ambitions?
I think she does. What I heard was that she might run for the Senate. But the problem is that kind of thing, unresolved thing, a killing, you know, an extrajudicial killing could kill her chances of higher office. So it's the only person who could run for president actually is Senator Bongbong Marcos. In fact, we know that he is being pushed by his mother, Imelda, to run. Oh, one thing about Imelda.
Ah, yes.
Imelda.
That name is very familiar,
you know,
yes.
There is a picture of Imelda together with a very young Donald Trump.
Hmm.
They knew each other from way back, you know. So I would not be surprised if the Marcoses have been in touch, at least to congratulate your president.
there are a lot of Filipino Americans in the Bay Area, and we've gone a bit further than I even thought because you're so good. Raisa Robles is a blogger and correspondent for the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong and author of the book Marcos, Martial Law, Never Again. And we're talking about Rodrigo Duterte and his regime in the Philippines and the similarities to other authoritarian regimes around the world and some that we find a bit closer to home. We have a little bit more time with Raisa, so if you have questions, give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You know, Raisa, we were talking before we went on the air about the fact that nowadays being a journalist can require some courage. So my guess is that you've had some pushback and maybe some controversy around your writing. So just how openly can reporters write about what's happening in the Philippines?
At the moment, reporters can still openly write, but they have to be prepared for the backlash of violent language, especially online, which, you know, under ordinary circumstances would amount to grave threats under our laws, our criminal law. But it just keeps happening day after day.
It's been determined that the Philippines is actually a very dangerous place for journalists, yes?
Yes, it has always been dangerous for journalists. Since 1986, up to the time before Rodrigo Duterte became president, there were 155 killings of journalists. And then a lot of them were killed in just one day. That is what you would call the Maguindanao or the Ampatuan massacre.
When was
if
that?
If you recall, in 2009. Yeah. And then under the Duterte presidency, since he took office a year ago, there have been four journalists killed. You know, President Duterte has, in his first press conference after, you know, after he became president, outlined in very clear terms in a press conference to journalists that he said on national TV, just because you're a journalist, you are not exempted from assassination if you're a son of a bitch. He said, most of those killed, to be frank, have done something. You won't be killed if you don't do anything wrong. Freedom of expression won't save you. The Constitution cannot help you if you smear a person. That's what he told journalists. And we got his message loud and clear. And I think that has had a chilling effect on journalists and certainly on me. I had been, I was trying to write articles on the war on drugs, but that thing was always at the back of my mind.
I can imagine. Have you been threatened personally and specifically?
Yes, on on online, on Twitter and on Facebook, and at one point, Duterte's son, a vice mayor of Davao City, told me that I needed to pray. Because of something that I asked on online, and I wondered why should the son of a president tell me that I needed to pray?
Has it affected how you've covered and whether you feel safe even going back and forth into the country?
I don't feel safe actually whenever I go out. I'm always looking to the left and to the right of me because now a lot of journalists like me are wary of people riding in motorcycles. We call them riding in tandems because most of the killings of suspected drug addicts have been done by two men on board the same motorcycle. You know, one drives, the other one shoots. So it's a very scary time for us, but also a very exciting time for us. You know, we don't have to make up stories or, you know, we don't even have to magnify stories. The stories are magnified by themselves thanks to President Duterte. One thing that I can say, this is a rich field for investigative journalism. Mm-hmm. But President Duterte has actually put a clamp down on the amount of data that we can get from the government. For instance, we are now required to ask, I think the most senior policeman, if we wanted blotter, you know, police reports, on-the-spot reports of crimes that happen in the city. We cannot get that now. But let me make it clear, Duterte is not yet a full-blown dictator today, because there is the constitution that actually restricts his way of doing things to a certain extent. But he now has plans to replace the same constitution. And once he does that, then all bets are off.
It's an extraordinary time in your country. And before we let you go, I really want to ask about the Filipino view of American political life now with Donald Trump in office. Has their view of America and Americans shifted? I mean, there's a huge military base there. It looks like Duterte is kind of turning his attention to the East and to Moscow and away from U.S. and Washington. So what do they think of the American political climate now?
Well, okay, let me divide my answer into two. Traditionally, all poll surveys have shown that Filipinos love America. Whoever is the president, Filipinos love America, and China the least, I think. And as for Donald Trump, I think that they also look at Trump the way they look at Duterte, except that they are afraid, of course, for their families who are abroad because of the threat of nuclear war, you know. But, okay, President Trump is visiting Manila this November, okay? Opinions are divided on this. It means that Duterte is veering now towards the U.S., and he would have a more balanced approach to his foreign policy, you know, balancing China and the U.S. But at the same time, the visit of Donald Trump would mean that he is putting an imprimatur on Duterte's war on drugs. And that is what is worrying those who are against the extrajudicial killings.
Well, it has been a fascinating discussion. And again, the courage that it takes to be a journalist nowadays, you are to be commended. Raisa Robles, who is a blogger, and we've been talking about the media landscape in the Philippines under President Rodrigo Duterte and his deadly war on drugs. It has been a fascinating conversation. Raisa, thank you so much for being here. And we're going to take a break now. When we come back, we're going to talk about the devastating fires in the North Bay. 31 known dead, 400 reported missing, 3,500 structures destroyed. Stay with us. We're coming right back.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard on today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Tweet us at Your Call Radio.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And you can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org. Or, by all means, give us a call, 866-798-8255. We're going to switch gears here, and we're going to talk about the fires in the North Bay. We're joined now by Jeremy White. Jeremy is the West Coast correspondent for The Independent and former political reporter for the Sacramento Bee. Thanks so much for being here, Jeremy. And it's been extraordinary to see the images coming out of the area. And, you know, the bottom line is that in many cases, the reporters are right there on the front lines covering the dangers and the heartbreak and the recovery in that area. So thanks a lot for being there and covering the stories. And just give me your thoughts on where things stand now. What is this, day five?
Well, thanks for having me on. I certainly wouldn't equate what my fellow reporters and I have been through with folks who have been evacuated or who have been battling those fires day and night. But, this situation looks like one that is unlikely to resolve anytime soon. Mm-hmm. The winds that helped whip up these fires on Sunday night have returned, and fire officials have been pretty clear for the last couple of days now that the conditions that allowed these fires to ignite and spread so aggressively have not gone away. There's a lot of dry vegetation out there. We may have had a rainy year, but we still have 5 years of record-setting drought. So the message from the fire chief is that the extra moisture that was in the ground from that wet year has pretty much all dried up, and we are back to essentially drought conditions with what he said was explosively dry vegetation. So a couple of these fires are a little more contained this morning. The two major fires, Tubbs and the Atlas Fire in Napa and Sonoma County, are up to about 25% containment, which is an improvement. Much of this week they were at 0%, but the message seems to be we still have a ways to go before folks are out of danger here.
And you've been there from the beginning. Can you talk about literally watching it escalate and explode right before your eyes?
Well, I don't know that I was there where the fire itself was exploding, so I can't speak to that. But I can certainly tell you, going to Santa Rosa and speaking to folks who were evacuated or lost their homes, going and seeing parts of the city that were destroyed, it's pretty astonishing to be standing on a block and one side of the street there will be houses standing, and the other side of the street it's nothing but ash and some chimneys and some car frames. So it is a pretty chaotic situation up there. There are shelters that are full of elderly folks who have been evacuated from nursing homes and hospitals. Messages everywhere from loved ones searching for family members. Authorities are slowly whittling down the list of missing persons, but that's going to take some more time, and it seems nearly certain at this point that that list of casualties, which as of this morning was at 31 dead, is probably going to rise as they continue to track down missing people.
You know, for those of us who were around for the Oakland Hills fire, I don't know if you covered that, but some of the imagery is so hauntingly similar that there is literally a firestorm. It creates its own weather, and I don't know how close you've gotten to those kinds of conditions, but I just wonder if you've ever actually been in fear. Have you gotten close enough to actually wonder, can I get back out of here?
I have been lucky enough not to get that close. The authorities have been sealing off the roads leading up to sort of the worst fire areas. But, it is striking how close those areas can be to populated areas like the city of Santa Rosa, which is part of what makes these fires especially devastating and unlike pretty much anything we've seen before, in that it's not just out in the wildlands. It's really neighborhood by neighborhood in some of these cities. The statistic yesterday from the mayor of Santa Rosa was upwards of 2,800 homes are destroyed. So that is it's a pretty monumental toll.
And certainly the urban wildland interface has changed a great deal. But again, having covered the Oakland Hills fire, there were a lot of things that you could just see were just a catastrophe waiting to happen. Things like very narrow streets, so narrow that a fire engine couldn't get around corners. And when people were trying to evacuate, there were cars parked on the side of the road that reduced a two-lane narrow road down to only one. And I'm wondering if there are particular circumstances that you're seeing in areas like Santa Rosa that made this particularly challenging to fight the fires, and whether the conditions there were kind of a setup for this sort of thing.
Well, one of the messages consistently from fire officials has been part of the reason that, you know, as I said, you've seen earlier this week that the fires were still stuck at 0%, 3% containment, is that so much of their effort has been toward protecting people's lives and homes, that has really been the priority of sort of battling to keep these fires out of urban areas, which you know, it's a form of triage, if you will, and I think with they have implored people to listen to evacuation orders, to be ready to go as soon as possible. You know, we've seen more and more evacuations as the week has gone on. I've spoken to folks who at 2 a.m. Were roused out of bed by a sheriff's bullhorn and had to get out of there, and there has been situations where there's been quite a bit of traffic as people have tried to leave. I spoke to one man who was on the verge of getting out of his car and making a run for it, you know, in the middle of the night with flames all around. They ended up managing to get out. He said people were actually fairly courteous, and it wasn't too much of a panic in terms of people getting out of there. But that is part of the messages from authorities, is really asking people to be proactive about evacuating, and especially to stay off the roads if you don't have to be driving, to ensure that if there are more evacuations, people will be able to get out of there.
We're talking to Jeremy White, West Coast correspondent for The Independent, former political reporter for the Sacramento Bee. If you have thoughts about what's happening in the North Bay and the fires, 866-798-8255 is the number. Jeremy, I'm wondering, some of the reporting really has been extraordinary. They've been the fires have been covered extensively by local media organizations. The Santa Rosa Press-Democrat is doing an excellent job. The Sacramento Bee, the Chronicle. Is there any reporting that stands out to you in terms of quality or quantity of coverage?
You know, as you said, there are so many folks out there doing great coverage. Two of the ones you mentioned, the Press Democrat and the Chronicle, have been doing a great job. I think the LA Times has been doing a fantastic job as well. My former colleagues at the Sacramento Bee. You know, again, in a situation like this, I don't want to make journalists seem like the heroes. People are out there doing their jobs, and certainly a lot of folks are having a much tougher week than we are. But, yeah, I mean, I think certainly, especially as sort of stories of the victims are increasingly coming out, you are seeing some really terrific reporting, and you know, I'm proud of my colleagues.
And you're reporting for a British audience. Suddenly, this story is leading newscasts, national newscasts. But what do you want your readers to know about what has happened here in Northern California?
I think it can be hard, given that you know, we hear about California wildfires often. I think I'm trying to help people grasp just how extraordinary this is, both in terms of the scale and, again, the fact that we are seeing urban areas being threatened. You know, every fire season we cover these fires, and there have been some bad ones. Certainly in the last few years, there have been some very devastating ones, but this is a different animal.
Well, there are approximately 22 fires, some of them have actually consolidated, so there might be fewer now, but about 200,000 acres across 8 Northern California counties. There has been a state of emergency declared. What has that meant, if anything, the declaration?
That's just something that you know, allows more resources to be poured into the effort. officials, in addition to dispatching something like 8,000 firefighters and 650 fire engines from California, they've been getting federal help. Several neighboring states, they've requested more firefighters, more equipment to help deal with the fires. So they are really sort of enlisting other states, federal partners, everything California can marshal to not only battle the fires as they are now, but to try to get out in front and anticipate where more resources are going to be needed. It's still a volatile situation. Like I said, those winds that helped whip up these fires in the first place are still blowing down through there and are expected to through the weekend, which more possibility for fires to sort of change directions to blow embers into new places. So, you know, those emergency declarations, it's part of that effort to just throw as much at these fires as they possibly can.
And I must say, I've been watching the weather forecast calling for wind gusts upwards of 25 miles an hour tonight. And Sunday night was so extraordinary. The winds were just so weird. I had never felt anything like it. And when I saw these fire trucks screaming past, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, well, thank goodness they're being mobilized if there's a fire in the Oakland Hills area. But no, they were actually headed to the North Bay. So it sort of begs the question, what if those resources that are now mobilized in the North Bay, what happens if, God forbid, something happens here in the San Francisco Bay Area? Are the resources spread so thinly that there is the ability or lack of ability to respond elsewhere?
Well, I don't want to speculate too much about what California does and doesn't have the capacity for in terms of new fires igniting, but it's safe to say that people are stretched thin. I'm hearing stories of folks who are working multiple consecutive shifts out there fighting these fires, and it is an intense effort, and they are putting everything they have into it. So. Certainly, yeah, it is testing the system's capacity.
How has social media changed your reporting?
I think in a situation like this, social media has become a way for us to get glimpses of a situation like this that we might not otherwise, just in terms of people, for example, posting some video of what they've experienced. There's been some pretty astonishing video of, for example, people escaping a fire in their cars and that type of thing. Social media has also been something that you have seen public officials looking to, county officials, sheriff's officials, fire officials, trying to get the word out to folks about here's where the shelters are. The Sonoma County Twitter account yesterday was reiterating to people that nobody was going to be asked about immigration status at shelters, trying to dispel a rumor there. So I think that's something that is increasingly a tool used by public officials, which is coming into play particularly here because there have been some questions about these emergency alerts that not everyone got, and concerns about whether those were as effective as they could have been.
Okay, let's take a call. Tom in Alameda, thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to really express my appreciation as a layman and observer of the wonderful work being done on the ground by the firefighters.
Yes, indeed.
And the frontline journalists. However, I wanted to ask a long-term question. Are the politicians and the scientists looking at the long-term after the rescues are over and the cleanup after the put out of the fire, that our future spells more and more wildfires such as this due to global climate change? And what are we doing about what you just mentioned a minute ago, this scarcity of resources to fight the fires? Why are we not considering activating the National Guard permanently and even the U.S. Army to fight these fires, which will spring across the West Coast with regularity, not just this one in Napa County, but the one in L.A. a year or two ago was devastating. Why do we have to expect millions of acres consumed by these fires when back in 2001, George Bush was able to transport 100,000 U.S. soldiers, tanks, and equipment all across the Atlantic Ocean to Iraq overnight. What's stopping us here?
Okay, thank you, Tom. I know when you're covering what's happening immediately on the ground, Jeremy, that it may be difficult to kind of look beyond this event to the what's next, but that's what Tom is asking. If it's true that something like 100 million trees died since the last, because of the drought, can we expect more of this? And what are the implications of a changing landscape?
It's an excellent question. You know, the dead trees, which was driven by a combination of invasive species and drought, has been an issue for a while now. The state has done things about it. If I'm remembering correctly, the governor even issued a ways back a declaration to help get some more resources into dealing with that issue. But, you know, climate change has been something that has been at the top of the agenda for the governor now for a while in his second term. He's made it very clear that it is sort of his long-term priority. And at a press conference the other day, after various fire officials sort of gave the briefing on the size of the fire and where things stood, Governor Brown focused on climate change in his remarks. And he made clear, as he has repeatedly in the past during previous fire seasons, that a warming climate is going to lead to more of this type of sort of large-scale fire. And, you know, he has been very focused on legislation to help reduce California's carbon emissions and cope with climate change. And so I think, you know, he is very much focused, as are other state lawmakers, with dealing with climate change, in part acknowledging how vulnerable California is, not just in terms of wildfires, but in terms of sea level rise, for example. So, you know, I think it can be difficult to see a direct immediate effect of legislation requiring more energy to be generated from renewables, for example, to fire suppression. But I think it's all part of sort of a larger effort.
And for those who are not actively involved in the environmental movement, all of a sudden, when the air in outside your door is being compared to that of Beijing, to what extent do you think that suddenly there are going to be a lot more Californians who are taking more of an interest in how what land resources and land management and climate change and those kinds of things? Is that likely to be the takeaway here, that people are going to be paying closer attention after this kind of a disaster?
Well, I think for folks in the Bay Area who are seeing some pretty dirty air this week, I think a lot of those folks are probably already on board with climate change being a serious issue and something to deal with. But, you know, I think every time we have one of these fires, it again sort of raises the question of folks who are living sort of further out in those wildlands where there is greater fire risk. So I think that is, you know, an issue that we're going to hear people talking about, even as, you know, these fires are unusual in how they have menaced populated areas. Mm. I think there's still that larger question of, you know, as California's population grows, are more people living and buying homes and building homes in dangerous areas? And particularly if we are in a warming climate, which increases the risk of fires, sort of what does that mean long term?
You know, as we kind of come down the home stretch here, Jeremy, I wanted to talk about the human toll that this has taken. Again, as of an hour or so ago, there were 31 fatalities. Do you have a feel for how these people succumbed? For example, did they refuse to evacuate, or did they die in the process of evacuation, or was it more secondarily to the fire itself that most of these victims succumbed?
You know, it's been a mix of things. Details are slowly emerging about it. There were certainly some people who were just trapped. A few of the victims have been identified already. They've been older folks who were less mobile. There was a really powerful story in the San Francisco Chronicle today about an older couple that tried to flee, got trapped, and ended up taking cover in their pool. The man survived. Tragically, his wife did not in that situation. But, you know, I think these fires have been moving so fast and unpredictably that in a lot of cases, folks have just gotten trapped. And we are probably going to see this toll rise as they continue to identify missing people. The Sonoma County Sheriff told us yesterday that of the, as they're continuing to try to identify hundreds of people who are missing, they are dispatching cadaver dogs, and he warned that some of those identifications are going to be difficult because in some cases they're finding, I think his phrase was ash and bone is what's remained of some of these people. So it's pretty grim, and I think there's unfortunately going to be more of that to come.
There's also just a plethora of stories about heroes and people who are fighting to save other people's homes, even as they are notified that their own homes have burned to the ground. Can you just share some of the stories of heroism, both among the firefighters, but average everyday folks maybe opening their homes or preparing meals or taking pets? What kinds of stories have you heard around the human beings helping human beings?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think the silver lining to a situation like this is it does really bring out a good side of people who want to help. I mean, if you go to one of these evacuation shelters, there are just donations pouring in nonstop, folks coming out to volunteer who want to do something to help. I was not able to confirm this story, but I spoke to a woman who apartment manager of her apartment and the one next to it was there, in the middle of the night, opening doors, helping folks escape, doing everything he could, going back there, even at risk to himself. I have no reason to disbelieve the story. I just wasn't able to speak to the guy himself. But, I think after the chaos of sort of fleeing your home in the middle of the night, folks are hoping to help out, especially those who see the devastation in their communities.
And where is the National Guard? Actually, we have a question from Diane in Sonoma County. She wants to know, where is the National Guard? And a previous caller asked the same thing. Are they anywhere in evidence?
They are. The National Guard has deployed well over 1,000 people. I'm trying to find the most recent figures, but they have been deploying folks to help out with the effort and some aircraft as well. So the National Guard has been activated, and they've been sending people to join the fight. I don't know if I could tell you exactly where in the state they are, but certainly part of that all-hands-on effort has involved the National Guard. As of yesterday's briefing, there were over 1,600 personnel in the area with more on their way. They had mobilized and deployed a 500-person infantry battalion from Southern California, and they have something like 27 aircraft, including some from the Nevada National Guard that are joining the fight.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Jeremy White, you have been just valuable to us as you stand there, kind of in the midst of what is just a battle for life and property. Jeremy White is the West Coast correspondent for The Independent and the former political reporter for Sacramento Bee. Earlier in the hour, we spoke with investigative journalist Raisa Robles, and we'll put up a link to yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.